thank you very much indeed, and once again, congratulations to Lord Selborne on chairing this inquiry extremely well, and it was extremely interesting. I'm acutely aware that I'm going to be greatly outnumbered on this panel, let alone in this room, but I'm not in the country as a whole, so somebody's got to do it, and I will stand up and make the opposite case using many of the same examples that Peter has used. And I'd like to get one thing out of the way right at the start. I'm enthusiastically in favour of international collaboration, international funding and international organisation in science. You won't get a cigarette paper between me and Peter on that. I love the way science is a global activity, that every time you go to a lab, you meet people who originated everywhere and anywhere, yet all speak the same language, and by that I don't mean English, I mean reason, I mean love of evidence, I mean a passion for truth. Britain has been a welcoming country for scientists, and I want it to be even more so in the future. Our labs are more diverse than our Premier League teams, even. We must get the best and brightest from wherever they live, mix them together, and to coin a phrase, watch their ideas have sex. That way we will promote growth, yes, but even more important, we will generate knowledge. Consider the career of Britain's greatest 20th century scientist, born 100 years ago next month, Francis Crick. That's my opinion, by the way, but I did write a biography of him. His main collaborators were Kreisel, Perutz, Watson, Brenner, and Koch, not one of them British. The only Brit he collaborated with closely was Leslie Orgle, and that was in California. So I want to explain why I think membership of the EU is not much help to British science and technology overall, and may actually be a hindrance. And let me begin with an embarrassing admission of ignorance. Before we began this inquiry, I was under the impression that the main EU science programmes were only available to members of the European Union, FP7 Horizon 2020. And I find that I'm not alone. Last week I was talking to a distinguished psychologist and he said, but if we leave the EU, we lose access to the science funding. And I used to think that too. If we left the EU, we would lose access to those programmes which provide roughly 3% of our total R&D budget. And then it dawned on me that Switzerland, Norway, and Iceland were in these programmes too. And Israel, Tunisia, and Turkey. Altogether, 15 countries are in the EU science funding programmes, but not in the EU. It was 14 when we published our report, but another country joined last week, Georgia. And according to the press release from Brussels, its researchers will operate, and I quote, under the same conditions as their counterparts from EU member states. The three countries with the greatest funding per head of population from Horizon 2020 are non-EU countries, Iceland, Norway, and Switzerland. The country with the most project coordinators per head of population is Iceland. The idea that we have to be in the EU to be part of this programme is just a myth, an urban legend. Sure, we have to pay money in to get money out, but so does everybody. These programmes are simply membership clubs. And the same is true of the main scientific collaborations. The European Molecular Biology Organization, the European Space Agency, EU METSAT, these are pan-European, not EU projects. The particle accelerator at CERN actually crosses beneath a border between an EU and a non-EU country. The Higgs bosons do not have to show their passports, and the weasels do not pay tariffs as they pass. CERN gets less than 2% of its budget from the EU. As Peter can testify, I became a bit of a bore on our committee about this, a pedant even. I kept asking witnesses to clarify if by Europe they meant the EU, the EEA, the continent, or the European research area. And I kept asking them if their own organisations included non-EU members. At one point we had three witnesses in front of us from different organisations, EMBO, ITER, the fusion organisation, and LERU, the League of European Research Universities. And I asked them if they had non-EU members. All three of them had non-EU members. Ah, yes, I was told, you can have European money and you can join European organisations and you can coordinate European projects, but you cannot set policy. You're not at the table when science policy is set. Really? Why? Well, they told me you would not be represented on the Commission or in the European Parliament. Sorry, you mean to say that the European Parliament or the Commission is deciding how the money gets spent in Horizon 2020? In EMBO, in CERN, in the European Space Agency? If so, that's a scandal. In Britain, we have the Haldane principle to insist that scientists set their own priorities. Is that principle abandoned at the European level? If so, I'm really worried. Let's run through a list of Brussels' greatest hits affecting science. there was the Clinical Trials Directive, which destroyed clinical trials in this country, and according to Maurice Brown of Cambridge University, threatened patients' lives. We used to have 12% of the world clinical trials, but now we have 1%. Sure, the directive was eventually reformed so that it was more reasonable, but it took 10 years, and clinical trials had by then largely moved abroad. There was the Data Protection Directive, which made many kinds of research much harder than on other continents. There was the Deliberate Release of Genetically Modified Organisms Directive, which has killed off this country's leading role in agricultural biotechnology. Now, true, in that case, the homegrown green fanatics started it, led by lords in white boiler suits. But ask scientists what's holding it back now, and they say the EU approval process for releasing GM crops or GM insects is so cumbersome, so uncertain and so unscientific that most scientists have given up even applying. In 2 weeks' time, we become subject to the Tobacco Products Directive, which contains a disastrous own goal for public health because it will make it harder for smokers to quit by taking up vaping. Why did this happen? Because big pharmaceutical companies lobbied hard in Brussels in favour of their prescription medicine alternatives, patches and gums, while subsidised tobacco growers and the tobacco industry also lobbied hard to have vaping devices included in a tobacco directive, even though they are not tobacco products. 15 years ago, diesel car makers successfully lobbied for the European Commission to favour diesel cars as a way of cutting carbon dioxide emissions, with the result that particulate and NOx emissions are far worse than they could be, resulting in thousands of unnecessary deaths. Homeopaths have successfully lobbied in Brussels to be excused from the need to prove their medicines are efficacious. Big green pressure groups have lobbied the Commission to get neonicotinoid pesticides banned, despite clear scientific evidence that they're less of a risk to bees than the alternatives. Greens lobbied in Parliament last month to get Roundup herbicide banned, despite clear scientific evidence that it's one-tenth as carcinogenic as coffee, and you ingest coffee, which you don't herbicide. I'm sorry, but if we're to leave science policy to the European Parliament, a hotbed of anti-scientific gullibility and big business lobbying, then we'll set science back. Some of our witnesses agreed with me on this. They said that Parliament is often anti-scientific, that the Commission's interpretation of the precautionary principle does stifle innovation by holding the new to a higher standard than the old and by ignoring the potential benefits of innovation, focusing only on the hazard. Brussels, in other words, is good at evidence-based policymaking, is not so good at evidence-based policymaking as policy-based evidence-making. A centralised, top-down, lobby-ready nature of the European system is one of the main reasons that, for example, the company BASF is abandoning Europe for America. New internet rules by the EU, which The Economist says will hurt the continent's startups, are one reason that Spotify, one of the very few European digital startups of any size, is threatening to abandon Europe for America. Under pressure from big publishers, the Commission is preparing a frontal attack on the hyperlink, the basic building block of the internet. So for me, in the end, it's all about innovation. I'm afraid I think the European Union is bad at doing it, good at discouraging it, repeatedly sides with those who have vested interest in resisting it, and holds Britain back from achieving it. Where are the European digital giants to rival Apple and Amazon, Google, Facebook and Wikipedia? Britain needs to be setting the scientific pace at a global, not a regional level. It needs to be an international scientific superstar. For its size, Britain is probably the world's leading scientific country. We have less than 1% of the world's population, but 15% of the most highly cited scientific papers, and more Nobel Prize winners than any other European country. Our biggest science collaborator is America. The only EU universities in the world's top 20 are British. We are world leaders in biotechnology and digital technology, and our greatest potential collaborators and potential rivals are in Asia and America, not Europe. So it's vital that we remain open to the world. A regional customs union protected by tariff walls and run from a central bureaucracy is a 1950s idea. In an age when container shipping has collapsed the cost of intercontinental trade, when the internet and budget airlines and Skype have made it as easy to collaborate with Asia and America and Africa as with Europe, regionalism makes less sense. Harmonizing standards is a good idea, yes, but doing so at the regional level makes no sense. In fintech, in car making, in ag tech, in digital, in biotech, the action is at the global level, where our voice is just 1/28th of a seat. we could be chairing some of these bodies. What about free movement of people? I suggest that continuing membership of the EU, not departure from it, carries the greater threat to free movement of scientists and technologists. And I say that based not on speculation about what might happen in the future, but on what is already happening now. Universities are quite rightly complaining about how much harder it is to get visas for students and professors to come here from India, China, America, Australia, and elsewhere. The academic world is rife with stories about us missing out on the best talent because of visa problems. I recently heard tell of a brilliant New Zealand physicist at Oxford who wanted to stay, partly because he loves cricket, but he had to go to Stanford because it was just too hard to get a visa to stay here. I talked to another scientist who advertised recently for a postdoc under a European funding grant and had one outstanding and several mediocre replies. But the outstanding one was holding out for a higher salary than advertised. My friend was told by his university that he could pay more than the advertised salary if the applicant was European, but not if he was not. The applicant has an Indian passport. I talked to a friend in India who was barely able to contain his rage at Theresa May for making it so hard for his most talented students to get to the UK institutions. Why is Mrs. May making it so hard for scientists from outside the EU? It's really very simple. Her government promised to reduce net migration below 100,000 and is failing to meet its targets. Since it cannot by law stop unqualified Poles and Romanians from coming here to seek work, then instead it is trying to stifle entries by non-EU citizens. So the difficulty universities are finding in getting talented people from the rest of the world is directly related to our membership of the EU. The connection could not be clearer. We have clamped down on Indian scientists because we cannot clamp down on Romanian fruit pickers. And the same is true for students. The least qualified Spanish student has more right to subsidized fees than the most qualified Argentinian student. America, Canada, and Australia have higher proportions of overseas researchers in them than Britain, Germany, or France. And they have stricter general immigration policies. If we left, took control of immigration, and adopted a point system like Australia, we would be able to open up to more skilled migrants from America, Asia, and just as many from Europe, to have an expedited academic talent visa like America has. There is not a cat in hell's chance that Brexit would be followed by restrictive visas for European scientists. Nobody is calling for that. So here's a fact to leave you with. 90% of the STEM graduates in the world in 2030 will be from outside the EU. Do we really want to be isolationist little Europeans and turn our backs on them? Thank you.